One, two, three, four.
Is this yours?
No.
Which one I am?
No.
Mind it, Mr. Chairman.
The veterans patriotic.
Patriotic. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Michael Hurley. I'm the Director of State Government Relations for ConocoPhillips, Alaska, out of Anchorage. And with me today is Mr. Michael Fraley, who's tax counsel for ConocoPhillips in Anchorage. Mr. Chairman, ConocoPhillips opposes House Bill 128. And Mr. Fraley will talk through some of the reasons for that in just a moment. I would be perhaps remiss if I didn't kind of take this opportunity to talk a little bit about PPT and the background against which House Bill 128 plays. Mr. Chairman, many of the committee members here, many of the folks in the room, put a lot of effort, time, and energy last year into developing, debating, and passing the PPT that we have today. From ConocoPhillips' perspective, what we saw was a more than doubling of ConocoPhillips' taxes for last year. And ConocoPhillips believes that the way PPT is set up now, we don't believe that's going to lead to more investment in the state, which we all desperately need to keep the industry healthy and to keep taps full. All that being said, we want to testify today on the changes in House Bill 128 and why we oppose them. You would think that from all the discussion that's been going on the last couple of hearings, a lot of this tends to focus on BP. But, Mr. Chairman, the situations that have given rise to this bill are situations at the Prudhoe Bay unit. And at the Prudhoe Bay unit, ConocoPhillips actually owns significantly greater percentage than BP does. So when people talk about wanting to do something about the situation at Prudhoe Bay, ConocoPhillips is actually very heavily impacted. So we do have a dog in this fight. We have a bigger dog, if you will. So we would like to go ahead and explain why we think House Bill 128 is going to be bad public policy, bad tax policy for the state. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Fraley.
Good afternoon, Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Michael Fraley, and I'm a tax attorney for ConocoPhillips. ConocoPhillips opposes House Bill 128 for multiple reasons. First reason is we believe it's bad tax policy. We believe it's a targeted tax. It's targeted at the situation that happened last year at the Prudhoe Bay unit. We do not believe a generally applicable tax statute should target one specific set of circumstances. I think that's bad tax policy. Second, we believe this creates an atmosphere of instability. before the PPT, the ink on the PPT is even dry. The legislature is already talking about reopening it. We don't have regulations. We just yesterday filed our first estimated monthly tax payment. We still have not filed our true-up for last year. That's not due until March 31st. Because of these reasons, we believe it's entirely too early to be reopening the PPT. Third, we believe the existing statute already covers the issues that House Bill 128 looks to solve. First, AS 4355-165E6 introduces legal standards by which, if violated, no cost would be allowed to be deducted. E8 disallows any legal cost that a producer has against the state or that any working interest owner has against one another. E16 specifically disallows lease expenditures related to oil spill cleanup costs. And finally, E18, and this is the most important one, addresses the replacements, the reduction actually of capital expenditures, 30-cent reduction of capital expenditures for every barrel, for every year. And E18 came in specifically, not in the first session, the regular session, or the first two special sessions, but it only came into being, its genesis was after the PBU incident took place. And what it is, it's a broad brush. Instead of narrowly tailoring and going after specific instances as HB 128 does, it's a broad-based, we don't want to keep track of every single improper maintenance or issue we have, so instead we'll just, every year, we'll reduce every single barrel or reduce your capital expenditures by 30 cents. This was made clear by Pedro Van Muren in his letter of August 5th. I believe it's one of the handouts today. This is the first one. Mm-hmm. And on page 5 of that handout. It discusses deemed capital maintenance cost. It reads, another concern is that is regularly expressed is that the state should not permit the deduction of cost relating to replacing equipment that is becoming defective or gathering lines that need to be replaced because of corrosion or other problems. The argument is that these assets should have been better maintained in the first place. Mr. Van Muren followed this up with another letter on August 8th. And to summarize that letter, in the third paragraph, the second sentence, he puts forth the question. And the question is, should companies receive a tax deduction and a tax credit together for 40% of the value under the 2020 system for replacing a pipeline that was defective and not properly maintained? The last sentence on the first page there answers that question, or his solution for it. And it was, my suggestion is to allow the first 30 cent per BTU equivalent barrel as lease expenditures to disallow that first 30 cents. His reason for that is he believes that this would provide a good answer to possible public criticism that under the PPT we should provide 50% of the replacement cost of pipelines as a result of the Prudhoe Bay shutdown. The result of that, in his calculation, is that the industry would pay between $40 and $42.5 million every single year due to not properly maintaining our equipment or our facilities. Therefore, this has already been addressed. E18 came up the same time that E19 did. E19 twice failed. And instead of using a narrowly tailored approach, the legislature decided to go with a broad-based approach in the law. Therefore, we see this as double dipping. This is addressing the same problem, a problem that's already been solved, a problem that has been solved, and the industry will have to pay it to a tune of $40 to $42.5 million every single year if production stays around 900,000 barrels a day. Therefore, we see no reason, or we do not understand why the legislature would reopen the PPT, reopen Pandora's box. Everybody's got things they don't like about the PPT. I'm sure not every industry included, But we just think it's too early to be opening the PPT.
Well, I think I can give you a simple answer as the sponsor of one of the two bills. And I believe the sponsor of the Senate bill would agree with me. I'll put words in his mouth. I think it comes down to legislative intent. We had no idea that the credits would be applied to gross negligence. And I think what we had on the North Slope would fit that. And I think we're not reopening the whole bill. We have no intention of opening the whole bill. It's merely fixing something that we could have never contemplated when we were doing the bill, that we would have a incident of this negligence and magnitude on the North Slope, and have the company look for the state to pick up a portion of it. So, again, I'm speaking just for myself, but I think I could speak for Senator Wagner on that, too. And that is the intent of both of these bills.
Representative, if I heard you correctly, you said if it was a result of gross negligence, and if it's a result of gross negligence, then it's already excluded under E6.
But it's still being applied for.
Still being applied for, but if it is determined that it's gross negligence, then the...
Again, this bill is setting legislative intent. We can't have everything and every bill. We had no idea that something like this would happen. I guess we could have expected it. We didn't. It's being fixed. We're not reopening every tax issue in the bill. But please continue.
The fourth reason that ConocoPhillips opposes this bill, and I hesitate even to discuss it because we are very strongly opposed to this bill, but is the fourth reason is the language that's the process that's been put in place by this bill. First, it uses a standard improper maintenance. We don't really understand that term. It's not a normally understood legal term. It doesn't have a lot of jurisprudence behind it. Second, it relies on the Department of Revenue. The Department of Revenue, I know many people over there, they're very competent, but their expertise is in tax, accounting, and auditing financial records, not in determining whether or not a proper maintenance program is in place. And they will be the final arbiter.
Well, again, we're in a situation where we left the proper maintenance to people that we could assume could do it and didn't. So we're trying something different, I guess.
Okay. And finally, because it will also be under taxpayer confidentiality, you can have a situation where a DOR auditor may come to ConocoPhillips and say, well, we believe this was improper and it's disallowed for you. But the same situation, a different auditor could go and talk to another working interest owner of that field and say, well, no, we believe it is proper, and we wouldn't know. You can get similarly situated taxpayers can be treated differently because this is under taxpayer confidentiality.
But I believe if we wanted to debate this issue, we have people in the room that could handle it, or people online, but I think at this point in time.
Understood.
Could you please wrap up?
Yeah, I will. For these reasons, ConocoPhillips opposes HB 128. We believe it's inappropriate. We believe it's redundant, creates instability, and has an extremely flawed process. To encourage investment in the state, we believe the law should be equitable, administrable, stable. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Any questions, Representative Ramos?
Thank you. So nice to have you, gentlemen.
You brought your big buck?
I brought my Black's Law Dictionary, but I'm just going to use my brain first. Mr. Chairman, with going back to last year, was Conoco a big advocate of fiscal certainty on oil? I don't recollect that was a significant issue for Conoco of the three major producers.
Through the chair, Representative Ramirez, there were lots of things that got negotiated amongst the different parties, and that was part of what was in that particular contract, but it probably wouldn't be appropriate to try and pick out.
I understand.
Who's doing what to whom.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My point basically is that from what my recollection is, and it's hazy, is that fiscal certainty was not a hot button issue for Conoco, but you were pulled into that debate by other producers. And so I can appreciate also when it comes to this issue that you are opposed to House Bill 128. You didn't create the problem necessarily, but but one of the other producers was not careful. And as a result, it pulls all the producers into the same boat. And that's kind of where I find myself, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the point of view of the producers, and I respect Conoco as a good steward of our resources, as a good corporate citizen in our state, and an exceptional organization that's created a lot of economic activity in Alaska. But because you move as a group sometimes, sometimes you're not judged by your own merits, but by the collective merits of the producers. And in this regard, I it's hard for me to separate out the interests of Conoco from the behavior of BP. And so I'm empathetic to the point of view that you have. And, you know, again, for the record, we'll suggest that we shouldn't be here, that if BP would step up and be a good corporate citizen, that I'd be the first guy to vote no for this on the floor. But short of that, I find myself to be a great advocate of your piece of legislation, Mr. Chairman, and I'm anxious to sit through the committee's testimony today and then do what I can to help move this along and make it into law, because what happened up there was inexcusable, even though I don't believe that it was Conoco's doing. But Conoco is like a, you know, who did this? All right, if then all of you, you know, hit the deck and give me 20 push-ups right now. And I would enjoy watching you do push-ups, Mr. Hurley, but my point's made. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Samuels.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question for Mr. Fraley. I asked the same thing of BP last year. The commercial arrangement between the two companies, if Conoco refused to pay, you said this is your problem, BP. If you refuse to pay, in your opinion, what happens? What Mr. Williams testified to was that they will attempt to deduct their share of these costs, and then whatever's allowable for the credit mechanisms also. If you refuse to pay, do they immediately file suit, or how does the arrangement for the unit agree? How are if you have an expenditure, if the operator wants to spend $100 million, I assume the owner companies have to get together and bless that and go forward now. So if BP is currently saying we're going to spend whatever this total amount of money is, have you guys agreed to that? Is that confidential? Have you and Exxon both said we will pay our share or will not pay our share?
For each of the segments, they will bring forth a business case. We'll evaluate that business case. And if we believe it's justified, then we would pay for it.
And I'm assuming that some of these repairs are taking place as we speak. So, I mean, is Conoco going to be affected if you don't claim the deduction on there because you never had, you're not going to pay, and BP is totally on the hook? Have those decisions been made at a corporate level by Conoco?
I think we're still evaluating that. You know, ultimately, if we believed it was as a result of gross negligence or an imprudent operator, then our corporate policy is not to pay.
Okay.
And through the chair, Representative Samuels, the unit process itself, the operator is required to come to the other working interest owners to get approval for those kinds of major expenditures. To best of my knowledge, that has not happened yet. There have been discussions amongst the owners about the plans to repair, replace, do what needs to be done. But that will sort itself out amongst the owners following the normal unit functions that go on for just about any expenditure that an operator makes.
If I could follow up, Mr. Chairman,
no, certainly.
What's a timeline? I mean, does this take by the time that Conoco decides and Exxon decides and they get back to the owner group and we go up through the bureaucracy and back down through your own internal bureaucracies, and you decide that we're not going to pay, BP, you're on your own for these expenditures that you had. What does it do to the statute of limitations? I guess I'm getting more into a question from Mr. Iverson. Does BP attempt to take the entire amount off I just kind of wonder, how much of a quagmire do we get into when Exxon and Conoco tell BP, this is your problem, we're not paying. The owners are not going to pay their fair share. And I don't know if it's a tax question or maybe Mr. Banks is here, somebody from DNR. How long does it take, and do we end up walking ourselves off a cliff if we're the state?
Through the chair, Representative Samuels, I don't believe that the decision process within the unit will take all that long amongst the owners.
Okay, thank you.
I think a lot of it depends on how contentious it is, but it should not run beyond the normal three-year audit process. I would think that the Department of Revenue has, and even if it did, I suspect those can be stayed.
Okay, thank you.
They have a process for that.
At the appropriate time, I'll probably ask Mr. Iverson the question. I see Mr. Banks in the audience on how it will flow for the state.
Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to make sure that I understand ConocoPhillips' position here. You'll be more heavily impacted if these are not allowable deductions because you got a bigger share of the action there. You're going to have to pay more of the cost to repair it. Is that the right way to understand
it? Through the chair, that is correct.
But you have, I would assume, the opportunity to try to make BP pay the whole thing by arguing that they didn't do the job that you were paying them to do. When you were paying them to do it, right, which is properly maintain the pipelines, is that right?
Through the chair, Representative Dugan, that is potentially correct. We haven't done that yet because
Right, I understand that.
Potential's out there.
I'm just trying to sort out the players here. So actually, your liability is somewhere between zero and what it's going to be for your share of the entire cost of making the repairs.
Through the chair, that is correct.
Okay. And on a slightly different point, I believe you said that ConocoPhillips doesn't believe that the PPT will lead to more investment in its current form.
Through the chair, that is correct.
And can you tell me briefly why that is?
Through the chair, Representative Dugan, we actually believe that the rate that the PPT was enacted at and the windfall profits tax piece that was layered onto it is such that it is a disincentive to investment, but it is going to take significantly more money out of the business, and it is not going to provide the kind of incentive that's going to incent investment in the state to the level that we think investment is needed in the state for new development.
So basically, you think we're taking too much money out of your pocket, huh?
Through the chair, that is correct.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Now, I'd like to add that a week ago we requested BP provide us with the date of the last time the Peter lines were pegged, and as of 30 minutes ago, they were unable to provide us with that date. So I'm thinking it must be back fairly far in the past, or they would have had access to that information. But
back before computer record keeping, perhaps.
Yeah. Any further questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Let's see. I notice we have Exxon in the room. Mr. Jardel, do you care to add anything?
No, thank you.
Do we have anybody else in the audience that would care to comment at this point in time? Please join us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jason Bruni. I'm the executive director of the Resource Development Council. RDC is a business association that has a very diverse membership. Our members include the oil and gas industry, mining companies, tourism, timber, all of the native corporations, municipalities, labor, very diverse organization, and it's on behalf of these members that I give my testimony today in opposition to House Bill 128. We believe it is a bad public policy and potentially precedent setting for other industries. With the passing of the PPT legislation last year, the state effectively tripled the production taxes on the oil industry in Alaska. This likely will result in over $1 billion in additional revenue to the state this fiscal year. In passing this legislation, the producers are now allowed to deduct operating costs from these taxes. In addition, they're also allowed to take a 20% tax credit for capital investments as an incentive for improving North Slope infrastructure. Further, as statute currently reads, lease expenditures may not include costs arising from fraud, willful misconduct, or gross negligence. HB 128 would preclude lease expenditures associated with improper maintenance of property or equipment. I ask, what exactly is improper maintenance? HB 128 does not define it. What does it take to qualify for improper maintenance? Does it take a spill? If the same pipe on another area of the slope existed and there wasn't a spill and the choice was made to replace that pipe, would that expense be allowable? What does it take? How do you define what improper maintenance is? In fact, industry guidelines on maintenance often change, in many instances, because of new information, and oftentimes that new information is gleaned from miscues. These miscues do not imply that the facilities were not properly maintained. However, despite the best of intentions, accidents do happen, even with proper maintenance. Expenses may not include costs arising from gross negligence. Gross negligence implies a careless disregard for the consequences of an action or lack of action. The state already has the protection it needs, and therefore HB 128 is unnecessary. Another large concern HB 128 creates for my members is the potential for endless litigation it creates. Even if improper maintenance is defined, our members feel this will just add to the potential for ongoing disputes between the state and the producers. RDC members strive to responsibly develop Alaska's natural resources. As we strive to do this, I request you not move HB 128 out of committee today. Give last year's PPT legislation a chance to work before changing it. Really appreciate the opportunity to comment today. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Any questions for Mr. Burton?
Hi, Jason.
Representative Ramos.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Nice to see you. Big supporter of the RDC. I appreciate all that you do for the state and the many diverse interests that you represent. Has the RDC prevailed upon BP to be a good corporate citizen in this unique case so that we wouldn't have cause to consider House Bill 128? Which I don't disagree with you that it's dangerous legislation and dangerous road to go down, but I would suggest to you that since August, when the Resource Committee of the 24th Legislature convened to have this conversation, and we had Steve Marshall in that chair, who's no longer with BP, along with a lot of other people that are no longer with BP, we asked them to consider this then, and that their corporate citizenship as good stewards of Alaska's resource and its reputation and its as a holder of its keys of integrity for the future development of ANWR or the area around the Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve, that all those things are influenced when we see a shirking of responsibility and a demonstration of in my opinion, bad faith and poor corporate citizenship. Has the RDC sat down with BP and had that dialogue with them?
Through the chair, Representative Ramos, no, we have not.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Online, we have John Norman, who spoke to us a week ago. John, do you have any further comments?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I'm principally, though, would want to spend my time on any questions you have, so perhaps I should begin that way and see if there are questions of the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, so that I use the time the way that you would like me to.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you. Representative Samuels.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On Mr. Norman, on page 3, line 21, you are mentioned, the chair of the AOGCC, relying on standard industry practices, and you're going to be consulted by Commissioner of DEC.
And then you will be determining the improperly maintained that standard under. So do you have any concerns? Is that something that AOTCC normally does, or?
Well, we do foresee complexities in doing this, and in a letter dated February 16th to Senator Wagner, through the chair to Representative Samuels, we expressed some of those complexities that we see. What we were trying to convey in that letter is that there is not on the shelf readily available a book of standards that can be pulled off and quickly consulted. So it is going to be a fairly complex assignment, but we're ready and willing to carry it out if that is the judgment of the legislature.
Any further questions for John Norman? Thanks for being with us, John. Are you going to stick around?
I will stick around.
We also have Robert Menz online. Robert, are you willing to testify, or are you questions only?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I'm here to answer questions if there are any.
I think Representative Samuels has at least one.
Thank you. Same question, Mr. Menz. We spoke in my office with Ethan, who I think I saw here earlier. There he is. On some of the exact terms on the bill, not the philosophy of the bill, but the term, the improperly maintained, and you said you had some concerns. Do you have any language that would get to the same place the bill is headed, but not create a new term?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Samuels, I don't have anything to propose it right at this moment, but the Department of Law is, I understand, getting the necessary authorization to provide that kind of assistance, and I'll be happy to work with them on it.
Okay. But do you think it's a concern or not?
Well, I just had kind of an initial reaction that there could be some tweaks to the language that might make it more better, easy to administer, and maybe more clearly address the committee's concerns. Just to me, the term improper kind of has not exactly the connotation that we're after, and it doesn't also, I think, completely include the idea of failure to maintain. So I think that we could come up with some changes that would hopefully fulfill the committee's intent, just a little more clear and a way that could be better implemented.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you very much. We also have Steve Mulder online. Steve, questions or statement?
Mr. Chairman, no, I'm here for questions if there are any. Basically, I was asked to make myself available in case there were questions about the Department of Law's ongoing investigation at this point.
Representative Samuels.
Sure, I'll bite. Can you tell us about the Department of Law's ongoing investigation?
Well, I can't share a lot because it is ongoing, but some of the questions that arose is there presently any litigation? The answer to that is no. We are in the process of doing the investigation that Attorney General Dave Marcus outlined before the Resources Committees in August. He formed a task force within the department, and we're following through on collection of documents through subpoenas that were issued last summer, and reviewing and evaluating those, and which will lead to further steps.
And Mr. Chairman, if I could, what's a timeline on that? If you're just kind of preparing for potential litigation, I seem to remember that then Attorney General Marquez had said that the lost revenue that the state had because of the shutdown would be reimbursed. You would not be able to say that you're just going to get the money on the back end. You know, 50 years from now, you have the same amount of aggregate oil, so there was no loss to the state. That would be one of the factors the state would be looking at.
That'll be certainly one of the issues that we are and will be evaluating. As far as the timeline, it's still early. too early in the stage for me to predict how many months out we might be to making a recommendation on that. We won't have all of BP's documents under the subpoenas probably for another 60 to 90 days, or at least the first segment of it, and then there's other paper documents that are not in the digital form. They'll take longer to address and probably won't make our way through all of those until sometime later this year. And then we also have subpoenas out to the other producers that we've yet to begin looking at documents under those.
And thank you. Thank you. Are there any concerns that if you are preparing for litigation, that by the time you litigate, and both scenarios, whether this piece of legislation passed essentially in the form that it's in now, or if it did not pass at all, the deductions, if the bill doesn't pass, the deductions will have been taken. How long do we have to go back, assuming that we're filing suit on a similar subject material? What kind of a problem does that create if we're going 5 years on a lawsuit and we're going to have to look back on a deduction that was taken in 2007?
I guess I don't have an answer to that question. That'll be one for us to look at.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
One
more follow-up.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. Are you aware, is the federal government also doing the same thing with potential litigation? Is there any litigation from the federal side, or are they collecting information for potential litigation?
I don't believe there's any litigation from the federal side. There is, it's my understanding that the federal side has an ongoing investigation, but beyond that, I don't have any details.
Okay. And are there any criminal investigations going on by the state?
As outlined by Attorney General Marcus in August, our criminal division has its own investigation.
They do have an investigation.
Pardon?
They do have an investigation?
Yes.
And would you have any sort of a timeline on that?
I have no information on that.
Okay. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much.
All right. You're welcome.
The committee should be aware that we've also got Don Bullock, drafter of the bill, in the audience. And if anybody has any questions for Don, we can bring him up for the table. No questions? Anybody else in the audience that would wish to testify? Well, we'll bring it back to the committee. Representative Samuels.
I don't know who to ask. I see Mr. Banks or Mr. Iverson's name online here, but I had the same question on that I had last week to BP and asked a couple of minutes ago to Conoco. If the bill did not pass, the commercial arrangement between the entities, if Conoco and Exxon refused to pay BP, the unit owners said no, BP still had the expenditure, does BP get to deduct the entire amount, and how would that be determined?
Representative Samuels, the chair. My name is Kevin Banks. I'm the division of the, acting director of the division of oil and gas, and a little bit rattled. I didn't see the airport until after we landed a few hours ago.
But you made it.
There are a couple things I can respond to in that question, and let me give it a try. And I really do think it needs. It's a question that probably should also be pitched to the tax director, John Iverson. It's my understanding that that the grounds for one company not paying another for such maintenance, for example, would be things like gross negligence, so that there's some harmony right now between what PPT says about disallowed costs and what unit agreements have to say about it, unit operating agreements have to say about it. In that situation, if that were the case, then the same standards would apply. And the state in that situation, I believe, it would not be an allowable cost under the PPT because it would be gross negligence.
And if I could, Mr. Chairman. So if, let's assume for the sake of the hypothetical here, that Conoco and Exxon do not pay BP because their claim of gross negligence, they make a deal internally, is that subject to review by the state? Or do you have access to the information that they had to avoid the gross negligent term being thrown out there by a ruling of a court in a civil suit between the two entities? And to follow up on the same question, just to, I'd like your thoughts on the whole subject. If the suit was filed, if BP filed suit against the owners of the unit to get their money back, because they are going to spend the money, they're not going to have to get permission first. They're going to spend the money to do either re-sleeving or the new pipe. What happens in a lawsuit between the three of the largest corporations in the world 10 years from now when we look back on whether it was deducted or not? How long do we have a statute of limitations on the tax return? Does that create any kind of a problem whether we do or do not pass the bill in either scenario? I assume it's easier if we do pass the bill and then it becomes a moot point.
Representative Samuels, through the chair. Let me try to answer the first question first, and maybe by making the statement, I can flag the issue for the benefit of pursuing the question a little bit further with Tax Division. I seem to recall that in allowing a cost or disallowing costs in the course of an audit, that whether or not a partner in an operating agreement has paid another partner for a cost or not serves as evidence of whether or not the cost should be allowed. So it would be my impression then that the auditor would now see that here's a charge made by the operator but was not reimbursed for by the other partners. And then that would be reason or as I say, evidence of a disallowed cost, okay, as I recall. And your second question, actually, I suspect that there are statutes of limitations on tax cases. If the tax case, an audit were to occur 3 years from the year of the event that we're talking about, or some disallowed cost and a settlement was reached between the state and the taxpayer, or some other a formal resolution before an administrative law judge were to be decided. My suspicions are at that point the matter is closed, and that if there's some if the disagreement among the parties it takes longer than that, and something some deal is struck among the parties later than that, I don't know that the state would have an opportunity to recover that. That's almost rank speculation on my part. I do apologize.
All you have to do is know a little bit more than we do, though.
Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And in my case, you don't have to know very much at all to know a little bit more than I do. If the law currently, as it's currently written, does not allow deductions in cases of gross negligence, then we have to assume that the letter that was sent by the president of BP Alaska, in which he said they were going to deduct costs from this event, is an assertion that this was not gross negligence. If this bill didn't pass, what would happen then? Essentially, they would make a claim that they could deduct these costs. You'd have an auditor that would review those claim and make a determination as to whether or not the state agreed. Is that the process that would occur there?
Again, Representative Dugan, through the chair, it's a question that's probably best answered by John Iverson of the Tax Division. I believe he's online, and I know how the Department of Natural Resources audits costs where relevant in our own royalty audits, and similar types of provisions in our lease exist, for gross negligence and that sort of thing. And I think it is correct that Mr. Suttle's assertion, you know, you can imply is that the costs were made or charges were made in a way that they felt was absolutely necessary and reasonable, and that should the tax division agree with that assessment, they will be deducted. And to the extent that they are capital improvements, they will also form credit, tax credits.
I guess maybe, well, I guess maybe I want to talk, ask John Iverson the questions here then, I think.
Yeah, if there are no further questions for Mr. Banks, again, thank you for flying in for this. And
well, that might have been one of the reasons for being here. Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Iverson. Oh.
Okay. Don't go anywhere, though.
Mr. Iverson, are you online?
I am, Mr. Chairman. This is John Iverson.
Care to weigh in?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for the opportunity. There were a couple of issues here that sounds like need to be addressed. We do have a 3-year time period in which we can audit. If the costs are being disputed by the working interest owners to the operating agreement during that time, and we essentially hit the end of our 3-year period, we have several options at that point. One of which would be execute a tolling agreement with the parties, with the taxpayer, to extend that time. If they refuse to do that, then we would just issue a jeopardy assessment. And it's also known as, in my understanding, a blue sky assessment, where we would go ahead and assess it according to our beliefs of the situation. And if it is based on a lack of information, then we would assess accordingly. And in that case, we would assess to most likely exclude the costs from deductibility or from credits in order to preserve our claim as the state. That was one issue. And I think that covers, the other question that has come up is the effect of a dispute. Mr. Banks is correct. If there is a dispute between the working interest owners, that's certainly evidence. If there is one thing that I would like to make clear, too, is that if there's a settlement, interestingly enough, the statutes provide that we can actually look to the agreement. So, and to the typical practices and standards in the state to determine what costs would be allowable. The fact that those costs are disputed in the first place, regardless of whether there's a settlement that's reached later, is also evidence that we can look to. So, a settlement that would be reached by the parties wouldn't necessarily control what we would be doing as a tax division. I hope that was helpful.
Yes.
Representative Dugan.
It was, Mr. Chairman, but it didn't exactly get to my question. I'm assuming that, and I guess I should ask this as a question, John, rather than assume it. The state can contest deduction claims on its own hook, can't it?
Representative Dugan, through the chair, as far as I'm assuming that you're saying if there's a claim that they're making for a deduction, that's right. We can, through the assessment process, an audit process, we would say, no, that is not an appropriate claim for a deduction or for a credit. And then presumably either the taxpayer agrees to that and pays accordingly or goes into the appeal process. So then there would be an informal appeal within the department where that decision would be reviewed. And then from there, if the taxpayer, depending on how that decision comes out, the taxpayer may also appeal that to a formal appeal level, which would be typically in the Office of Administrative Hearings in front of an administrative law judge. If the dispute continues from there and they decide to appeal it to Superior Court, then it becomes public knowledge and then it's a regular Superior Court battle.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative Ramirez.
That's my question.
No.
Representative Samuels.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Iverson. That answered most of my questions. Last week you testified that you were in favor of the bill as written, and law says that they were still trying to come up with potential some language for it seems to be the term that is causing some of the heartburn is the improperly maintained. The law was trying to come up with a better way to define that, but last week you testified that you're in favor of it as written. So what's the conflict?
Representative Samuels, through the chair. as far as, you know, I certainly think there's certainly room for improvement here. I am certainly in favor of, and the administration, I think, is in favor of addressing this particular, these issues, these improper maintenance issues, whether it be in regard to the incident that happened last summer or as a general matter. With that in mind, my intention in saying that, you know, we support the bill is we support that that principle. I support the idea of addressing this question. With the language in the bill that was there last time we spoke, it was had been changed from relying on standard industry practices to taking into consideration standard industry practices. What that does in my mind is it allows us to not rely exclusively on the standard industry practices in making these decisions, which gives us more flexibility in addressing the improper maintenance issue in case the practices are wrong or inappropriate or simply don't apply to the situation that's at hand.
Okay, thank you. And I've got one other question, and I don't know. I think it's going to be for the Department of Law, for Mr. Mulder, but anybody can feel free to jump in, I guess. If there's a civil case or if Representative Rambis just wants them to not take the deduction, would that be used, could that be used as evidence in a criminal case then by saying that by not taking the deduction we admit we have gross negligence and therefore the criminal charges, does it enhance a criminal case then? Mr. Banks is not a criminal lawyer, and he's not going to answer that question.
This is John Iverson. I'm sorry, through the chair. Was that question posed to me?
Well, I think it's probably for Department of Law for Mr. Mulder, but I don't know who it's to. I'd like an answer to it. I'm not going to, you know, the bill's going to move on, I'm assuming, Mr. Chairman, to the next committee, but I'd like to have the answer to the question sometime in the process. If BP, either what Representative Rambis just wants him to not claim the deduction or make a deal with the state or anything, if they do any of those things, if they don't fight every step of the way, is that going to be used in a criminal case against some of the individuals involved, the employees of BP, as evidence of their culpability in doing something which they're not prepared to admit to in a criminal court? And I no idea what the answer to the question is, or
Samuel, through the chair, I would actually defer to I'd say Rob Mintz or Mr. Mulder to answer that question. I don't.
Well, gentlemen, we still have you both online.
Yeah, this is a Mr. Chairman, this is Steve Mulder. It's really probably a question for the criminal division, a criminal evidentiary issue. And I'm on the civil side, so I wouldn't have a definitive answer on that. My off-the-cuff reaction is that probably be more in the nature of a settlement. It wouldn't be admissible, but I can't say that with a high degree of confidence. And if the answer to that question is important, we can track it down for you.
Yeah. I'd like to know the answer to that, both on a federal criminal investigation or a potential federal indictment or a potential state indictment, either one, because I heard the answer earlier that both tracks are moving forward on a potential criminal investigation. I'd like to be curious here, what can be used in the arena that we're talking about right now, what could be used as evidence in that criminal case?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
This is Robert Mintz. I don't really have anything to add on that particular question, but since I've just been unmuted for the first time in a long time, I could offer to perhaps answer a little bit more fully one of Representative Dugan's questions from a couple of minutes ago, if the committee would be interested.
Oh, certainly.
Okay, this had to do with the question of, I think the question is, if there's some sort of dispute or settlement or decision as to whether working interest owners are going to pay or not pay costs that the operator bills in connection with, say, corrosion long-term repair of pipeline, is that how does that affect the department's ability independently to challenge the cost deductions? Am I kind of getting at what the representative was asking about?
Yeah.
Okay, and I think that the short answer is it depends. And the reason I say that is I think it's maybe informative to go back to some basic elements of the new production tax statute. 4355-165 deals with the term lease expenditures in two different but related ways. And lease expenditures is the term the statute uses for the costs that are deductible in calculating the production tax. And 165A has a very general definition of lease expenditures, and these are the ordinary and necessary costs that are direct costs of exploring for developing or producing oil or gas deposits. And here's where you find the language where the statute says that in determining whether costs are lease expenditures, in other words, whether they're deductible, the department is supposed to consider, among other things, two factors. And one is the typical industry practices that are revealed in existing unit operating agreements in terms of what types of costs operators are allowed to bill the working interest owners. And the other factor is the Department of Natural Resources regulations on what costs are deductible for net profit share leases. Now, if that general definition is being applied, then any time a taxpayer deducts costs in calculating its taxes, when the department audits it, the department it's the department's responsibility to determine whether the particular costs meet that general definition. And in addition to that general definition, of course, there's been a lot of reference to subsection E, which has 18 different exclusions. So regardless of whether something would meet the general definition, if it's in one of those excluded categories, for example, due to gross negligence, then it's not deductible. But in addition to that general definition, if you look at subsection C and D of section 165, here's where we get into the situation where the department is allowed to approve or to require producers to actually rely on the unit operating agreement billings in determining what are deductible lease expenditures. And in particular, under subsection D, the department may, and let's just suppose, and this hasn't happened yet because it's too early in the process, but let's suppose that the department in the future does decide it will approve use of the Prudhoe Bay Unit Operating Agreement as the basis for deciding what costs are deductible lease expenditures. Then at that point, the department is going to be relying on the working interest owners to basically look out for their own interests, because the state, you know, has like a 22.5% interest, but the working interest owners have a much higher individual interest in not paying more than they are required to pay. And so if you look at this provision of the bill, it says that the lease expenditures are the costs that are billed to the producer by the operator under the agreement and are either not disputed by a working interest owner or are finally determined to be properly billable as a result of dispute resolution. So in that type of situation, if the department has approved use of the unit operating agreement, then in that then it's going to be relying on what's billed under the agreement, and whether or not the working interest owners dispute that or accept it. So again, there are kind of two situations. There's the general situation where the department can go back to square one in terms of auditing and determining whether a cost was properly deductible. And then there's the other situation where it's determined that there's enough kind of adverse interest and effective auditing by working interest owners that it can rely on the operating agreements and the bills under the operating agreements to determine what are properly deductible. And in that case, if we assume that, I believe the first witness today said that that typically if a cost is due to either an imprudent behavior by an operator or a gross negligence, that the working interest owner would refuse to pay it. And if that's stuck as a result of any dispute resolution, then it wouldn't be paid and it would not be considered a lease expenditure, would not be deductible. And that concludes my explanation. I hope that was somewhat understandable. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Don Bullock, would you care to weigh in on anything that we might have missed today?
Just for a moment.
Thanks again, Mr. Banks.
Thank you.
Hello again, my name's Don Bullock. I'm one of your attorneys and from Ledge Legal. Just general comments about how the PPT generally works, and that is that the legislature makes a policy decision as to which credits and which deductions are going to be allowed. And for every credit and a deduction, there's a decision that says, well, we're going to give up part of our revenue because this particular deduction and credit's a good thing or not. And really what you're doing here is you're making a policy decision as to what expenses the state wants to participate in and what not. And this bill presents you one of those options. What level of care do you expect from a field operator? And if they fall below, or you know, it's really a question of what you're willing to share the cost of.
Any questions for Mr. Bullock? Thanks again.
Thanks.
I think with that, we'll bring it back to the committee. There's apparently no further testimony. And what's the will of the committee?
I have one more question, Mr.
Chairman. One
more question. And just some information from the folks at ConocoPhillips and perhaps BP, if there's somebody from BP here. Is Mr. Hurley, I believe, testified that there wasn't a long timeline before the unit owners made decisions on what they would pay back. I mean, the unit owners are going to say reject or accept the BP expenditures or not. And I'm just kind of curious, from more of a, not an exact day timeline, but in 2 years, 2 months. What I just heard Mr. Min say was that if you reject it, if the operators reject the claims, then they can't deduct them anyway. So when does that decision get made on the timeline on any typical operating expense like this? Not that this is typical.
For the record, again, this is Michael Hurley with ConocoPhillips. Through the chair, Representative Samuels, there will actually be several different stages of, if you will, decisions that will have to happen. The first stage will probably be the submission of AFEs, authorizations for expenditure by the operator to the working interest owners for approval. That is normally done for capital projects. Matter of fact, it's a requirement of the unit agreement that they have to be done for capital projects above certain dollar limitations. You have to get explicit approval from the owners before you can undertake those projects.
So anything that has been expended so far and has not been approved cannot be considered a capital expenditure by definition?
No, that's not true. It would have to fall below certain dollar level hurdles that the operator has the ability to do on its own.
So they can operate.
And certainly the operator can do things on an emergency basis if they need to and deal with it later. I mean, we may be difficult companies, but we're not inflexible when the need arises.
Yes.
But the timeline for AFE approvals is one thing. And then later on, at some point, the operator will be billing costs to the working interest owners, either through an AFE that has been approved, or they may do it through their own approved expense budgets to run the field. And right now, we don't know how that's all going to play out.
But those are not things that normally take years and years to decide.
Months and months, or a year, or realizing that every case is a little bit different, but ongoing. But I'm just
through the chair. It quite often takes months and months to decide, because a lot of times when you're going out for a major capital project, they're large expenditures. They're involved technically. There's a lot of folks at all the different companies who review the technical details of particular projects and argue back and forth amongst themselves as to what kinds of things ought to be done. That's standard procedure within the unit owners.
So has BP gone forward with their AFE to the owner group? Is it in the hopper? I mean, are we on the timeline already?
Through the chair, Representative Samuels, there have been some preliminary discussions, but as of the end of last week, when I talked to our technical folks, they had not received any AFEs yet.
Okay, and is that public information that DNR has access to? Some of it might be proprietary, but the state does have access to seeing that. We'd know if that had been done, or is that
through the chair? No, you wouldn't normally know that had been done, because there are times when AFEs are put forward by the operator or even by other working interest owners that don't get approved. I mean, an authorization for expenditure is basically a proposal that
to go spend.
The operator goes and makes to the other owners and says, hey, here's what we'd like to do, here's why, here's the economics, here's the health, safety, environmental impacts, here's this, here's that, and they discuss it.
Okay. Thank you.
No further questions? Thank you again, Mr. Hurley. With that, we'll close public testimony at this point in time and bring it back to the committee. Representative Dugan.
Mr. Chairman, would it be appropriate? I wanted to say a couple of things for the record here.
Oh, certainly.
You know, we've listened to several people say that they oppose this bill and give various reasons for that. And I'll just sort of take my outline and Mr. Fraley's testimony as representative of that, not that I'm picking on him. But he says, first of all, that this is targeted at the situation at the Prudhoe Bay unit. And in fact, I think that my colleague from Fairbanks would be happier if it were simply targeted at that. But Mr. Bullock has told us that we can't write that sort of piece of legislation, that we have to write, I believe, what the governor calls a law of general application. And that we could assume that if we have this sort of a situation now, that we may have a similar situation in the future. And so this law is actually as much prospective as it is based on the case that we have before us. Second, a couple of people have said this in different ways, that changing the law so quickly creates what they call an atmosphere of instability. And I'd submit that anyone who expects the legislature to write a law and have it stay exactly the same way for any foreseeable period of time in the light of changing circumstances has got an unreasonable definition of stability. We might not be having this discussion if the situation on the slope hadn't happened. We certainly wouldn't be having this discussion if BP hadn't notified us that they were going to be deducting these costs. Those are not situations that anybody ever thought of at the time that the bill was being written, or that we could have reasonably foreseen. There's a claim that existing law covers this, that the 30 cents per barrel exemption was intended to cover exactly not just this sort of event, but this event. I've had people who I respect in this building tell me exactly that. I have people who I respect in this building tell me exactly the opposite. And frankly, I wasn't here. So I don't mean to be choosing sides here, but I'm afraid I can't assume that that was the case. And lastly, that the language is so vague that we're going to have litigation. Well, we're going to have litigation on this bill, on many aspects of this bill, I would suspect. You know, the history of the states changing its oil taxes is fraught with litigation. and I don't see any reason to suspect that that's going to be any difference. And in fact, one way of looking at the legislature's decision to opt for a profits tax rather than a gross tax is to say that they had a higher tolerance for litigation than they might otherwise have had. Having, you know, said all that, what we're left with is a bill that right now only allows us really any latitude on a situation like the one on the North Slope in the case of what are criminal standards, right? As I sit here, I can imagine situations in which you wouldn't be violating the criminal law, and yet you still would not allow want to allow the deductions. And it's my hope that that's what this bill does, and that's why I'm going to be voting to send it out of committee. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Samuels.
Nope.
Well, I think we'll take a brief at ease until Representative Ramirez gets back, and we'll roll it out.
I've got a couple of comments I want to make.
Oh, well, we're back in. Representative Ramirez.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just give me. Thank you. Just for the record, before we have an opportunity to move this bill, I also am not a big fan of House Bill 128. I share the point of view of the RDC and ConocoPhillips and the other producers that have come before us. I am troubled, Mr. Chairman, that we are inviting in a vague standard where gross negligence is right inside of my new book, but there is no definition for improper maintenance, and I'm troubled by that. And what I jetted off to my office to get, Mr. Chairman, is this speech that I've just been fascinated with since I saw it excerpted on television, and I'm going to just read from it briefly, Mr. Chairman. This is from Rex Tillerson, the chairman and CEO of ExxonMobil Corporation. It was his opening address to CERAWeek, which was an energy conference in Houston the week of February 13th. And the title of his speech was "The State of the Energy Industry, Strengths, Realities, and Solutions." And in fact, Mr. Chairman, I think one of the things that we're doing today is trying to attempt to innovate a solution to a problem that was not of our making, but the resolution, resolution of that is. And I'm just going to read very, very briefly Mr. Tillerson writes, industry, or it was a red speech, he was reading, industry timeframes. First, we must provide greater understanding of the reality of the timeframes within which our industry works to deliver this uninterrupted supply of energy. These are timeframes that often transcend the political cycle and most certainly the media cycle. Many policymakers think in increments of 2, 4, or 6 years based on election cycles. In contrast, those of us in the energy industry think in increments of 2, 4, or 6 decades based on timelines to gain access to new acreage, explore for, discover, and bring to production the next sources of supply. And I would submit to you, Mr. Chairman, that it is the failing of President Suttles and his organization to not just step up, pay to fix this thing, not try to deduct it, and not require us as folks that are chained to political cycles and to a certain responsibility to the constituencies that we represent to create what I think is a bad law that creates and invites a vague standard. But they have the solution is in their own hands. And I think it sets a bad precedent. Mr. Suttles did not come by my office when he was here in this building, and I do look forward to meeting him. I'm sure when he has more time that he will, and I do look forward to it because I think that the energy industry is, you know, what makes our state go, and I'm very respectful of that. But I'm also respectful of the state of Alaska, its rules, its laws, its environment, And I'm troubled when folks like us have to take up a bill like yours, Mr. Chairman, and react to a situation that we should not be placed in. We've been fussing around with this thing since this past summer when it happened, and there's no resolution, and this is surely not the A plan for fixing this problem. You know, I delivered copies of this speech to the Alliance, and I keep copies of it in my office because I think it's a fantastic speech from the Walmart of energy in the world, and that is the ExxonMobil Corporation. And they are requiring us as politicians to come up with a political solution for what really is just a good corporate citizenship problem. And I continue to be troubled, even as I vote to and vote a do pass to recommend this bill move on. I think that BP has it well within their power to solve this problem and not invite for the next 2, 4, or 6 decades into our energy policy and management of Alaska's resources a vague standard of this improper maintenance standard. It's an unknown thing, and it's shameful that we're going to have to litigate it. And we're having a hard time finding out what the dollar amount is, because you're having a difficult time getting the documents to support that figure, Mr. Chairman, from the precise entity that we're having a tough time squaring up. I don't see a representative from BP in the room.
In the building.
And it doesn't instill a lot of goodwill. And BP, it was arguably the best partner that Alaska had, going forward. And I'm sorry to see them to want to vacate that position as a shining example of how the state has strong partnerships. And so I guess that we are going to have to do just what Chair Tillerson, the chairman of Exxon, suggested, is we're going to have to apply a very imperfect, impractical, vague standard to try and address the situation. And it needn't be the case. And it's a shame for me. But I will be voting do pass. And I will be voting for this on the floor. And I will go home and tell my constituents why I did what I did. And I will wait around here in this building, Mr. Chairman, for the eventual litigation that surrounds this, and I will follow up after the fact if the voters continue to send me back here to do their business and look out for them in the interest of fairness. Thank you for letting me go on.
So will you make a motion to move version M out of committee?
I'm all out of energy, Mr. Chairman. I would move. Mr. Chairman, the CS for House Bill number 128, version 25-LSO561/M Bullock, nicely written, vague as it is, with personal recommendations and attached fiscal notes. And
is there any opposition? Moves on to the next committee. I will take a brief at ease.
Nicely written.
Oh, thank you. Next, we're going to hear a PowerPoint presentation on House Bill 89. After we hear that, the bill will be held up until... Well, just putting everybody on notice. We've talked about this with Representative Guerra. The AG bill is going to be the next thing on our plate, and that'll be the main thing that we'll have on the menu for the next couple weeks. But could you continue, Representative Guerra? And I'm going to come back where I can watch it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Other member of the committee. The I think what we can do in 20 minutes today is not really go through the bill, but go through what I think is needs to be changed. It can be changed with this bill. It can be changed with some version of a correction of the PPT bill. But I'd like to talk about two issues that face us right now. And one is that the PPT bill, intentionally by some, included subsidies for a gas pipeline. And those are in there, and they only benefit the holders of the Point Thompson lease and those who hold the current oil leases on the North Slope. And I think the intention was to benefit a producer-owned line last year, but now we're going to have new incentives with the new AGEA bill. And I think we have to think twice about whether we want to keep in roughly $1 to $2 billion worth of incentives in last year's bill on top of the new incentives added in this one. So the two issues I want to talk about are, one, are we subsidizing profitable operations that we don't have to subsidize? You should subsidize conduct that you want that wouldn't otherwise happen, but are we subsidizing things that we're going to be paid for anyway? The other question I want to address is, and we could use more Department of Revenue analysis on this, and I think we're going to get some, but I want to take a look and see how much less than the world tax average we're taxing under our PPT bill. And I think we have some very on-point information on that. We're projected to have budget deficits 2 years from now. And the question is, should we agree, if I'm right here in this PowerPoint, to tax at $1 to $2 billion a year less than we would if we taxed just at the world average? We've heard it before. Our duty, of course, is to maximize the benefit of our resources to the people of the state. The first issue I want to address is how we're taxing compared to other places in the world. BP came in and showed how we're taxing compared to certain other places in the world, the low-taxing jurisdictions in North America. But oil is a world commodity. The companies that produce here produce around the world, and they look around the world in deciding where to produce. We measure the worldwide tax rate with something that our consultants and the other consultants that we see writing about the subject called total government take. That's the portion of the oil's value that we get compared to the portion of profit the oil companies take. Econ One, Daniel Johnston, Wood Mackenzie, who've all presented to us, have come up with worldwide government take figures. According to Daniel Johnston, the average government take around the world is somewhere around 67% to 70%. Wood Mackenzie projects it at about 71%. And that, by the way, factors in the high costs of the state of Alaska to produce, and that leaves about 30% in terms of net income for the oil companies. And so it doesn't really matter that Alaska has a high cost of doing business. The government take numbers around the world sort of equalize that. And but the world average government take is, let's say, somewhere around 70%. According to Wood Mackenzie, who did a study for us, if you look at the bottom line, they did this in 2005, they estimated the world government take average to be about 70-73%. Daniel Johnston just for shorthand called it 71%. Well, what kind of government take applies under PPT? And you'll see at about $60 a barrel, the price of oil for the last year roughly, PPD produces a total government take when you add the state taxes with federal taxes, all the taxes paid in Alaska, a government take of about 61% at $60 a barrel. What does that mean in terms of revenue? And I'm going to let you know that the answer is not crystal clear. Econ One measures gave us measurements of what PPT would do for us over the next 10 years. The Department of Revenue gives us measures of what's going to happen this year and next year. And just informally, what I've been told so far by the folks at Revenue is that when you compare how much less we're getting to what we would be getting if we taxed at the world average, the number looks a lot better if we do it on a 10-year average than it does just for next year's numbers, and I can't tell you why. And they're going to look into that question. They're probably going to get us a report soon. Let's just take what we know. We know, and I'll show you from the Econ One charts, that Alaska's government take, the total government take in the state of Alaska is about 61%. We know the world average is about 67 to 71%. And at $60 a barrel, we know that each 1% loss or gain in government take changes state revenue by about $200 million. How do we know that? We've got a few of the Econ One charts that came out every time we did a PPT analysis last year, the top box is government take, and the next box is the amount of revenue we were going to get above the old tax system. So if you look under the $60 a barrel column, if we had a PPT that resulted in, let's say, the top line, a government take of about 60.8%, that's the top one, and then if you go down to the third line, and then compared it to a government take of a half a percent more, 61.3%. So you have 60.8 and 61.3%. That's about a half a percent of additional government take. How much more revenue does that produce? You go down under the $60 a barrel column. The 60.8% government take produced $1.8 billion more than the old tax that we had. That's what that number is. If you raised it by a half a percent to go to a 61.3 government take, you would produce $1.95 billion. So roughly $100 million more by increasing government take by a half a percent. And that's how we get, by increasing government take by 1%, you add or lose $200 million at a time. If you just want to double check this with another chart they proposed on with different versions of PPT, if you look at the top two ones, there was a government take at $60 a barrel, a 57% under one of the PPT versions, and another PPT version produced a government take of 62.5%, so that's about a 5% difference in government take. If you look at the top two lines in the next box, the 57% government take produced about $1 billion more than the old system. The 62% one produced $2.2 billion more than the old system. So that 5% difference in government takes had meant a difference of $1.2 billion, again, roughly $200, $225, $250 million a percentage. And this next box, it just shows the same thing. It's a different chart with different PPT versions. And they all show that basically roughly a $200 million difference, a little bit more, by changing the government take percentage by 1%. Well, what does that mean? I mean, how does that help us compare our tax system to the what would be an average tax charged around the world? There's about a 6% difference. We take about a 6% government take less than the minimum Daniel Johnston estimates as the world average of 67%. If he's right that it's a 70% average government take, we tax about 9% less. Wood Mackenzie, if we use their number, we tax about 10% less in terms of government take. And so that's somewhere between a $1.2 or $2 billion loss if you assume that the thing we should be doing is taxing somewhere around the world average. We tax about $1.5 billion less in the state of Alaska than we would if we taxed at the world average. Department of Revenue numbers, I think, are going to be lower, and what they're going to say is this year the loss isn't as much. If you average over the next 10 years, this is going to be the loss, but we're still waiting for their analysis. Well, should we tax at the world average? You know, I can't tell you that sitting here today. I think we heard when PPT was introduced by Governor Murkowski last year that his intention was that we tax somewhere around the world average, and that just never really came to pass. Let's just take another look at a measure of whether or not we're taking too much money under PPT or not. How profitable is Alaska production under PPT? Conoco is one of the few companies that reports its Alaska-based profits. Last year, in 2005, before PPT was in place, Conoco, at oil prices in the high 50s, took in $2.5 billion out of Alaska profits on total sales of about $6 billion, a profit margin of about 43%. Last year, the price of oil averaged around $60 a barrel. I think three-quarters of the tax here was paid under the PPT system. They still took in about $2.3 billion, a 37% profit margin, still quite healthy. If you look at profit margin numbers for sort of large Wall Street companies, you see them in the 10-15% range, and the 37% range, it's dot-com numbers or oil company numbers when oil prices are high. I think that's another suggestion that the state isn't taking its fair share for the value of oil that comes out of the state. There's the other point that I want to address. So point one is, are we maximizing the benefit to the people of the state of Alaska? I think the government take number helps us take a look at that. It's one measure. And I would recommend that maybe we ask the Department of Revenue to help us analyze that number even further so you don't have to take just the word on this PowerPoint. I mean, I think there are still some questions that have to be answered to come up with a more accurate number. question. The other question is, are we subsidizing things that we don't have to subsidize? And we need to address this question as we go ahead with the gas line. One of the things the PPT bill did was there's a 20% and a 22.5% essential credit and deduction in PPT. So for what we consider upstream construction on the North Slope for the production of gas, the things upstream of a gas treatment plant, we're going to subsidize with the 42.5% state contribution the development of Point Thompson, and we're going to subsidize gas field development in this way. We're going to allow the companies that produce oil and pay an oil tax in the state to deduct from the oil tax that they pay to us their cost of developing their gas fields. And I just want to address whether or not that's a good idea, especially in light of the additional subsidies that Governor Palin is going to produce or is proposing right now. Our best estimate of what the gas costs on the North Slope are going to be is, according to Econ 1, somewhere about $9.2 billion. And it's been told to me two separate ways whether that $9.2 billion includes the cost of the gas treatment plant on the North Slope that's going to be needed. That's about a $3 billion venture. So let's assume that that $9.2 billion includes the gas treatment plant, and the gas treatment plant is not deductible or creditable under PPT, then we just have to really worry about $6 billion worth of future gas costs. But here's the question on subsidizing gas field costs through deductions in the PPT tax. The expensive thing, we of course know, is going to be the development of the gas pipeline. We might have to subsidize that. That might be and is a risky, though potentially quite profitable, venture. But once a gas line is in place, why are we subsidizing the gas fields? Why are we subsidizing the fields of companies that know they're going to be able to put their gas into a $30 billion or $20 billion gas line? And I don't know that we should be paying 42% of the cost of developing gas fields that are developed with the full knowledge that there's going to be a gas pipeline waiting for them. And there are two issues there. This just estimates, let's assume the gas field cost, the future gas field cost, $6 billion, a 42% state payment. $2.5 billion of that is going to come out of company oil taxes. Let's go to Point Thompson first. It's estimated that the cost of developing Point Thompson is somewhere in the $2 to $3.5 billion range. I've heard the number $3 billion the most often. Don't take my word for it, but that's the number I've heard most often, a $3 billion project to develop Point Thompson. Under PPT, that would allow the companies that develop Point Thompson, right now it's Exxon as the main holder. They may not have that lease very soon, but right now it's Exxon. That would require that the state pitch in $1.2 billion for the cost of developing Point Thompson. Should the state pay $1.2 billion to develop Point Thompson? Well, year after year after year, the state has issued an order saying Point Thompson is a profitable venture. It's a profitable gas and oil field. It should be developed, and for years we've threatened to take the lease away from the leaseholders. And we've said it's a profitable venture. This is a 2005 order. We said it was a profitable venture at a time when the costs of developing Point Thompson were not deductible at all. We had a gross oil and a gross gas tax. There was no deduction allowed to the field owner, to the leaseholder, and we said still it's a profitable venture and we're going to take the lease back. Well, if it was profitable without any state subsidies, why are we going to now give the new leaseholder $1.2 billion in oil tax deductions for developing something we had ordered them previously to develop with no subsidies? I mean, that I think crosses the line between a subsidy and a giveaway. And many of us in both parties tried to delete this deduction last year. I think now that the governor is proposing an additional subsidy for the development of a gas pipeline, this one is no longer needed. So I think folks should take a look at this as we go ahead and consider the new subsidy scheme proposed by the governor. Here's the other problem. The development of Point Thompson, we assume, will occur during the period the gas pipeline is being developed. We will be getting no income from the production of gas at that point. In 2 years, it's predicted that we're going to start facing budget deficits. If we're going to face budget deficits starting 2 or 3 years from now, can we afford to add to those budget deficits another $1.2 billion in costs that I would say we shouldn't be paying in the first place. And that's one of the reasons that many people wrote last year, two of the constitutional fathers, that's one of the reasons they said we should separate the gas provisions in the PPT bill from oil. I think that was the view of many of us in the legislature last year. I think we have more information now to consider it. So the two things that we're facing as budget gaps are on their way is, does it make sense to tax $1 to $2 billion less than the world average for our oil commodity? And should we allow somewhere in the neighborhood of $1.5 upwards to $3 billion worth of deductions from our oil taxes for companies developing gas fields once they know there's going to be a gas pipeline in place? I think the answer to both of those questions is we need to take another look at our oil tax law as we go ahead. We spent a lot of time in this building discussing smaller amounts of money, the changes of business license fees, a fee for this and a fee for that, and whether or not we have $500,000 for this and that. Well, these are both billion-dollar issues, Mr. Chair, and I think we should resolve them in favor of changing both of those provisions in the PPT law. I certainly think it should be replaced by something like a gross tax that we propose, but it could be fixed within the PPT scheme too. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions for Representative Guerra? Thank you very much, Representative.
Thanks.
Well, with that, we'll adjourn till March 13th, and the only item on the agenda that day will be the governor's AGIA bill.